The Game of Kings, a sequence of programmes dedicated to the game of chess.
You see, I'm a lowly pawn.
You are not a lowly pawn, Herr Doctor. Don't pretend to be something that you are not.
A new adaptation for Drama on 3 of a celebrated chess novel, a Sunday feature exploring the game's universal appeal, and to start, a week of five voices in the essay.
What do you do if the rest of the world refuses to accept your passport? You play chess. With whom? With the Russians.
Checkmate, a sequence of programmes dedicated to chess, starts weeknights at 11 from Monday.
This is BBC Radio 3, broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now just after 12 midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The actor Julian Reintat will be familiar to lovers of both the supernatural and comedy. As Dr. Mac McCarthy in The Green Wing, he was a regular visitor to many houses on many evenings of the week. You've also recently been rather seasonal in terms of Halloween.
Yes, I have. I just appeared in an episode of Poirot called Halloween Party, written by my friend Mark.
Mark Gatiss, who was a guest on this very program.
He was a private passioner only recently, yes. Yeah, I mostly work when friends give me jobs, and that was very enjoyable. Yeah.
When The Green Wing started, you were just thinking of rather moving away from comedy and television, weren't you? Sort of.
Yeah, I think I considered myself to be a terribly serious actor. I said to my agent, there's two things I want to do. Get off the television and stop doing comedy. And she said, right. There's some people meeting in a church hall on Thursday talking about a new comedy series in a hospital. So I went down and met Stephen Mangan and all those other clever, funny people and ended up doing it.
You had quite a lot of music in your life, didn't you? You play the cello?
Yes, that's an interesting phrase, play the cello. But I did try, yes, from an early age. Yeah, I come from a musical family in that way, that genetic way that... These skills and talents often skip a generation. So my grandmother was a cellist and successful musician. And my grandfather, who I never met, was a guy called Guy Daines, who I believe used to lead the BBC Concert Orchestra. My sister is a very gifted oboist who still teaches the oboe, amongst other responsibilities in life. And my brother, Philip, plays the guitar. He's the headmaster of a school for special needs children. And he has a tremendous facility using his music to communicate and weave that into his job. But when I was young, it was my other youngest brother, Mortimer, who's still 10 years older than me, and he became a professional trumpet player. I was perhaps 8, 9, 10, and he was just starting out. He'd been to the Royal Academy, and he was playing in orchestras and some solo work. And to me at that time, when I was desperate to grow up and be an adult, he was doing everything that was so exciting to a nine-year-old boy at that time. He was going out, he was going to college, he was being with girls, and he was leading this apparently very exciting life as a touring musician. And that's why trumpet music has always been a big part of my life.
Thank you. the Adagio from the Concerto in D for Trumpets, Strings and Continuo by Telemann. We heard Håkon Hardenberger as the soloist with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, directed by Iona Brown.
Brilliant.
We're going to turn to the cello itself now.
Yes.
Julian Reintat, which of course is your instrument.
Yes, yes, amazing. Well, most of these pieces of music that I've chosen really are for me about just, not just the music, but tiny exquisite moments in your life when you first hear them that have imprinted themselves on me forever. Even with the trumpet piece we just heard, it's not only to do with my brother, but it's to do with this notion of friendship and how music welds itself into our life in this way. And it was actually the actor Sam West who handed me this music and said, I think you should listen to this particular movement. And it was an incredible moment. And in that way that he does, years later, he was at a festival and he met Håkon Hardenberger and he remembered that I loved this piece of music. And he got Hardenberger to sign the front of the CD and posted it to me. And when I received it, I was very touched that he'd remembered, and it was lovely. But the Bach cello suites is, again, from this time when I was a child and started to try and learn the cello. Paul Tourtellier was a major figure at that time. Obviously, he was an extraordinary cellist.
But he was also, thinking of your line of work, a very theatrical player, wasn't he?
He was very theatrical. Perhaps I was quite drawn to that. He was very charismatic. I went to see him play live. In fact, my brother, the trumpet player, once played in a concert in which he was the soloist. It was a very exciting evening to see this great man and know my brother was behind him somewhere. I remember at school once, I won a string playing prize. And it was absolutely terrible because it was quite clear that there were two other players who were far superior to me. But I got quite involved in sort of passionately waving my head and playing, appearing to believe in the music. And this fooled the inattentive judge. And I remember feeling ruthless elation at victory and at the same time the guilt of a slightly Pyrrhic victory, knowing that I'd really just moved my head. But yeah, perhaps that was the seed of being an actor.
And of course, this is wonderful music, which somehow bears the soul, doesn't it? It's just a single instrument, and yet it's so rich.
Yeah, there's so much depth that he gets in these contrapuntal voices and this amazing texture, this sort of mathematical genius of music that I get constantly lost in it. And it has a great sentimental affection for me because of my past. If you've played an instrument, even to a tiny degree, I always feel like I've had temporary day membership of a tiny club where you say, I can never do that, but I know how hard it is. And it makes it all the more extraordinary when you...
And what are the difficult things, would you say, for a player in a piece like that?
Well, for great experienced players, I'm sure it's nothing, but I do know when you first tackle those Bach suites, some of the early ones you can muddle your way through fairly easily. But by the time you get to that one, you're so high up the cello and you're using your left thumb, which is usually tucked behind the fingerboard, is up and out. And the sheer physical pressure with your hand that far down the fingerboard and the double stopping and the minute intonation flicking from open strings to the same note but in a fingered version is so hard for a mediocre player such as myself. So when you hear it done with such precision and such skill, it's...
And presumably that was before you fantastic. Broke your thumb.
You really do know some private passions, don't you? Before I broke my thumb...
Do you want to tell us about how you broke it?
Racing a motorcycle around Brands Hatch and falling off, yes. A rather pathetic injury. I wish I could make it sound more glamorous, but...
And hadn't somebody told you that you should tuck your arms in or something, but what they didn't tell you was you should let go of the handle.
Well, my great friend Tom, who is one of my true alpha male friends, a very experienced motorcyclist, said to me, if you do come off, just remember to tuck your arms in and not wave around, otherwise you can break your limbs. And as often happens with those sort of accidents, your entire life slows down and they appear to be happening in slow motion. And as I came off my bike on the hairpin corner at Brands Hatch, I do actually remember having a tiny smile to myself as I left the bike and going, Tom said, tuck your arms in. And so I did just manage to get into this fetal position as I scraped across 300 metres of gravel. And all was well. But yeah, I did forget to let go of the handlebars, which is another top tip. Yeah.
Well, playing with rather more certainty than you rode your bike, Paul Tertelier was playing the prelude from the suite number 6 in D for unaccompanied cello, BWV 1012, by Bach.
That, I must just say, that's a critical piece in the history of my life, because it's when I first decided I really wanted to become an actor. I was at university and we put on a play by Christopher Hampton called Total Eclipse. And I did it with my great friend Johnny Geller, who's now a famous literary agent, but at that time was a far superior actor to me at Warwick University. It was standing in the wings listening to that music and watching him act, and I thought, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Onwards, yes.
Onwards, and to actually a sort of another development in which is quite important to young men, I think, in the next piece.
What's that?
Well, Anne-Sophie Mutter is a violinist.
Ah, yes.
But it's not necessarily her that she was the object of your desire, but it could be said to be at a time when those possibilities opened up for you.
Her glamorous appearance on the classical stage is not completely irrelevant to this conversation, but... It's inexorably linked to this Tchaikovsky. It's really the next stage of my life when I was just leaving school. And that incredible moment when you rediscover music as part of your adult life, it's hard to explain. But if you grow up learning an instrument, there seems to be two sides. There's sitting in a quiet room on your own, practicing and learning your limitations as a musician. And then later on, you rediscover music as a purely pleasurable cultural experience. And I think I was about 18 and I went on a trip to Germany as an exchange. And only three people at my school did German. And so I had to arrange my own exchange. And my mum was working with someone in the office and they said, well, we've got a friend who needs a partner. You could go over there. Anyway, the guy couldn't do it. So I was paired up with his sister. And I turned up in Frankfurt and met this incredible 17-year-old German girl who was absolutely beautiful, passionate about English poetry, classical music. And I fell madly in love with her, with German culture, with everything about it. And it was at that time I was also discovering Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto.
Thank you.
And Sophie Mutter, who was playing music from the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto in D, Opus 35, the second movement, the Canzonetta Andante. The Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by André Previn. Julian Reintat, I think amongst your many achievements at this age, it was not only the cello, but also singing. You sang.
I did sing.
You sang well. But
no, that's good. I'm glad, yes. I did. Hilariously, I wangled my way into the elite choir at my school. And we did go on a number of tours of Germany and other places singing early church music. And so, despite having a resolutely secular upbringing and much scepticism around the world of religion, strangely, I found myself brought up surrounded by church music, church architecture, which has ingrained itself.
It's quite wonderful, though, isn't it? That I mean, because you're in the midst of great architecture, musical and literal, which sort of leaves its mark.
Completely. It's funny, especially when you're young and you don't really understand what it's all about, but these beautiful melodies and beautiful architecture somehow gets into your soul, and then it's only later that you begin to appreciate it.
And also that thing of being part of a team. I mean, having to listen to other people in order to fit in, which presumably is not so different from what you do now as an actor, although some of your colleagues may challenge that statement.
There's no me in team. Yes, choirs, schools and organised religion all do offer one great positive thing, which is some sort of template for living in a civilised society and guidelines for healthy living.
So this piece that you've chosen from those days by John Hilton, what do you particularly like about it?
It was just an absolutely exquisite melody that always I used to love singing. It was one of the few that I could probably sing vaguely in tune. It touched me every time I heard it. And it's just a stunningly beautiful piece of music.
We heard there the choir of Clare College Chapel, Cambridge, directed by Timothy Brown, in Lord, for Thy Tender Mercy's Sake by John Hilton. I was looking up his dates, and there are three question marks. So I think he was obviously 16th century, but it does come from that wonderfully clean, clear school of English, Tudor English music.
What it reminds me of is strangely, is this dichotomy that you find in the poetry of someone like John Donne, where ostensibly it's religious, clear, pure, written with rigour, but actually it's rather sensual and strangely romantic at the same time. And
sometimes even subversive, especially the metaphysical poets.
Yeah, exactly. So I think surreptitiously I'm drawn to that wild romance.
Well, actually, you're going from Tudor church music to what some people consider extremely indulgent music, which is the lush romanticism of Puccini.
Yeah, this is probably my most sentimental selection. It's to do with two things. One is just this interesting idea that opera, which I've always thought rather like green olives and German Lieder, is something that you can only mature into when you're older. And I only really got into opera later on by making a concerted effort to choose an opera, go off, study the libretto, learn the story, and then go and watch it unfold before me. And if you tackle it with that depth, you can get great rewards. But otherwise, I can suffer from just the warbling factor. But I've chosen this for a different reason, which is this idea that music is about these particular rare, exquisite moments when you hear a particular piece that sets it in your mind. And my mum died about 9 or 10 years ago of lung cancer. And as many people will know, that's always preceded by a long period of debilitating illness. And she was stuck in bed. And she died just after Christmas. But at that last Christmas, she made this extraordinary and superhuman effort to get out of bed and come downstairs and celebrate Christmas with us. And she had a few moments of great lucidity and energy, which I'm sure she was making a great effort to achieve for my dad. And she said she'd like to watch La Bohème, which was on the telly that Boxing Day. And I sat down with her and we watched it together. She was not a musical person, but she had a great sentimental love of the singing of the three great tenors. And we sat and watched this. And at the end, of course, there's the aria, which is fundamentally about a young woman dying of a respiratory-related disease. And the irony was, the resonance was not lost on us. But we sat there and didn't speak. But I knew that we were both... She was absolutely concentrated in watching this, and we had just had a very beautiful time together watching this opera. And she went upstairs and died a few days later. Mm. But I always remember that as a very special moment between us.
Grande Signore, rivedinni d'amore per sogni e per...
one of the most famous arias in opera, Your Tiny Hand is Frozen by Puccini, from La Bohème, Act One. We heard Luciano Pavarotti singing the role of Rodolfo, and the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Edward Downes. We're going to cleanse the palate again now, Julian, aren't we?
We are, with a sorbet of Andras Schiff.
Playing Bach?
Yes, it's easy to explain. The man's a genius, and I'm always fascinated by these, whether it be an actor or a musician. Why does one particular artist have this indefinable magical touch? And he has this huge brain, constantly playing the whole repertoire of Bach from memory, with such skill and yet never losing the beauty and romance of the music. I could listen to it all the time.
Andras Schiff playing the Minuets 1 and 2 from the French Suite No. 2 in C minor, BWV 813 by Bach. Well, another wonderful technique is put to use here, but it's the human voice in the next piece, Julian.
Yes, I like this for very similar reasons. It's not just to show off that I know about Lieder and therefore am grown up. But
it's good that we've established that.
We have established that I can now listen to complex romantic songs. But it's just this same thing, this idea that you've got these huge, sprawling Mahlerian symphonies that can be so impenetrable. And yet here in this tiny throwaway song, this ditty, there is such beauty and depth. This brilliant sense of complete upheaval and revolution at this cuckoo. dying and falling to its death. And then the nightingale coming in. It's fantastic.
Kuckuck hat sich zu Tode gefallen, an einer grünen Weide, weiden, weiden. Kuckuck ist tot, hat sich zu Tod gefallen. Wir sollen uns denn den Sommer lang die Zeit und Weil vertreiben? Wir sollen uns denn den Sommer lang die Zeit und Weil vertreiben. Ei, das soll tun Frau Nachtigall, die sitzt auf grünem Zweig. Die kleine, feine Nachtigall, die liebe, süße Nachtigall. Sie singt und springt, ist allzeit froh, wenn andere Vögel schweigen. Frau Nachtigall, die wohnt im grünen Hag. Und wenn der Kuckuck zu Ende ist, dann fängt sie an zu schlagen.
Christian Gerhard was the baritone, with Gerald Huber playing the piano, in Mahler's Erlösung im Sommer from Songs of Youth. Mm-hmm. One of the things I like about the programme, Julian, is when we tap the unexpected.
Yes.
And this is going to give great pleasure to a previous guest, John Snow.
I love John Snow. I like Channel 4 News sometimes. This is just about really those strange moments of elation that I feel sometimes when I listen to music. And although it's a very curious choice, the man who wrote it, Alan Hawkshaw, who I didn't know a great deal about, but I know he's a highly respected musician and has written many popular and well-known tunes over many years. And I just fell to thinking that it's extraordinary sometimes, even if you're not perhaps a famous contemporary modern composer, you can fall upon moments of strange genius, and I think that this is one of them. For me, it is the perfect balance between a fantastic fanfare. It does the perfect job of introducing a news programme without falling over the edge into pomposity. And there must be something good about it, because they haven't changed it since 1982.
But also it's a lovely thing that, you know, almost anonymous person, his music is heard by millions of people every day.
Yeah, yeah. It's fantastic. I just feel rather joyous every time I hear it.
Well, that was Alan Hawkshaw's Best Endeavours, also known as the theme to the Channel 4 news.
I think it was his best endeavour.
But it's back to Bach, Julian Reintat, and actually a wonderful organ piece now. Do you like organ music?
It's a paradoxical instrument, I think, the organ. It can either be this terrible, terrible instrument, desperately badly played and out of tune as someone struggles to get married. And,
so you've heard me play for
never be so rude. Or it sits as this gargantuan symbolic centre of all that's great about the complexity of Bach and his contemporaries. This great church organ music that Bach produced, I find hugely inspiring. And
this is a great player, David Good, playing a great piece, which is the Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Wacket auf, ruft uns die Stimme. BWV 645 by Bach, played by David Good.
I wanted to play that piece because it reminded me, as we listened to it again, of one of the most frightening moments of my life. I'm fascinated by all these soloists and the ability to perform in public while performing these great technical feats of playing. And one of the scariest moments was with my great friend, Roland Cotterill, who's a very accomplished organist himself, and I had to turn the pages for him in an organ concert, which paradoxically was far scarier than any other performance I've ever given.
Well, Prokofiev, finally, Julian Reintat.
Well, having been mired in my own sentimentality, barely got past 1750, it's a bit late in the day to proclaim myself as forward-thinking, but I thought we could end on an orgy of dissonance.
And yet, in a sense, such familiar dissonance that it's almost consonant.
Yeah. He has great memories for me because when I did hack my way through some pieces in an orchestra when I was young, this is one of the pieces we played, and it was... I chose this partly because we haven't got time to play oodles of other movements from this great piece, but also because this particular moment, the prince gives his order, is such an extraordinary cluster of dissonant chords and speaks volumes about his genius. And it was one of the most exciting moments in my brief amateur orchestral life to be in the middle of an orchestra when you hear this played. It's stunning, and to be playing the cello and then it suddenly everything stops and you're left with that tiny note coming out from the noise.
It's quite brilliant. A terrifying moment, actually.
It's a terrifying moment. Mm. It's completely fantastic. And he also embodies this brilliant paradox in Russian music of self-doubt, paranoia, and yet strangely inside this steely knowledge that he was onto something. And there are two sentences that always stuck in my mind that I read years ago about him, and I've always remembered, which I handily brought with me. And he said when he went to America, he said, "At times, as I roamed New York Central Park and I looked up at the skyscrapers, I would think with cold fury of all the wonderful orchestras in America that cared nothing about my music, of all the critics who never tired of uttering platitudes such as Beethoven is a great composer." And he said, "I had come here too soon. The child was not old enough to appreciate new music."
Well, eagle-eared and eyed listeners will know that we're talking about Prokofiev,
yeah,
and indeed Romeo and Juliet. And we're going to preface "The Prince Gives His Order" with "The Fight." Andrei Previn conducted the London Symphony Orchestra in The Fight, and the prince gives his order from Romeo and Juliet, Act 1, Scene 1, by Prokofiev. Well, thank you very much, Julian Reintat, for these glimpses into your musical passions. What are you addressing yourself to at the moment, work-wise?
It's a very dangerous question, isn't it?
Never ask an actor, because they're never quite sure. Yeah. But
I'm off to go and meet a fantastic actor called Dominic West for a new BBC series called The Hour, set in the 1950s, about the beginnings of television with a murder thrown in.
We look forward to that. Meanwhile, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for this indulgence. That was fantastic.
Julian Reintat was talking to Michael Barclay. Next Sunday, there's no edition of Private Passions, as Radio 3 will be celebrating Christmas with a day of festive music from around Europe. But on Sunday, the 26th of December, Michael Barclay's guest will be the psychologist and writer Pamela Stevenson Connolly, who's taken to the dance floor in the most recent series of Strictly Come Dancing. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. Today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
On Sunday nights on BBC Radio 3, we have a passion for all things choral. It's that day of the week when people all over the UK raise their voices together. And on BBC Radio 3, we have music from all choral genres across the UK and beyond. I'm Alan Jones. Have you ever thought about joining the choir? Sunday evenings at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. 1 o'clock is the time. The news now read by John Shea.
British investigators have been in contact with their Swedish counterparts, who are investigating two terrorist attacks in Stockholm. A man believed to be a suicide bomber died. The Swedish Prime Minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt, has condemned the attacks as unacceptable. The authorities in Sweden have confirmed that an email was sent to police before the attack, referring to Sweden's presence in Afghanistan. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has confirmed that demonstrators protesting over tuition fees on Thursday made physical contact with the Duchess of Cornwall inside a royal car. Clarence House has refused to confirm reports that she was poked with a stick. Scotland Yard says there's been a positive response to its release of pictures of 14 people wanted for questioning about the disturbances during the demonstrations in London against the rise in tuition fees. At least 11 people have died in a bomb blast in the Iraqi city of Ramadi. A suicide bomber detonated a car filled with explosives near government offices. Here, the government says it will consider banning a controversial American pastor from coming to the UK to address the ultra-nationalist English Defence League. Terry Jones caused international outcry earlier this year when he threatened to burn a copy of the Quran. Scotland's Schools Minister, Keith Brown, has been named as the country's new Transport Minister. It follows the resignation of Stuart Stevenson yesterday after criticism of his handling of the chaos caused by last week's severe winter weather. The heavy snowfall, which started during the rush hour on Monday morning, caused gridlock on Scotland's roads, with hundreds of people stuck overnight. Ministers have disclosed how much money will be paid to schools in England to improve the education of some of the poorest children. The pupil premium will be £430 for every child whose parents have an income below £16,000. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, says the funds will help tackle inequalities, but Labour says it's not a new investment. And the weather. A chilly day with light, mainly northerly winds. Fog will clear to leave many parts dry with sunny spells. However, there'll be a continuing risk of showers along eastern coasts. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at almost 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by John Shea. Well, time now on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, which today is presented by Robert Hollingworth.
In 1605, Monteverdi published the fifth of his 9 books of madrigals. It opened with what had already become an infamous piece, Crude Amarelli. Harsh and unpleasing to the ear was how theorist and critic Artusi had described it. It's hard to listen from a similar standpoint over 400 years later. But close your eyes, though perhaps not if you're driving, purge your souls of Brahms, Mozart, Bach, even Purcell. Think of Palestrina, and then take the Artusi test to see how shocked you can be by this. Concerto Italiano singing Cruel Amaryllis, the opening madrigal from Monteverdi's fifth book of five-part madrigals. Monteverdi arrived at the Mantuan court in 1590 at the age of just 23. He was a player of the theorbo, the large lute, and also the viol. The year after his death, his playing was described as a new Orpheus with the sound of his viol, in which he had no equals. He already had a number of publications under his belt, and his second and third books of madrigals were published soon after his arrival. But it would then be 11 long years before his extraordinary fourth book was printed, closely followed by his fifth, both arriving just after the first operas had been performed. It's not clear whether arch-theorist Artusi had actually heard a performance when he criticised that madrigal, but the passages he was taking issue with were still unaccompanied madrigals. Just a few pages later in the fifth book, though, Monteverdi nailed his modernist colours to the mast by using the new style, with a simple instrumental accompaniment providing the harmony, so freeing the voices from having to provide every note in the chord themselves, and allowing them more soloistic expression. This presumably sent Artusi absolutely apoplectic.
Si prima